My name is Miranda.
And I'm Kim.
And we are the 13 Club Podcast. We've got a special guest today that you can neither see nor hear, but it's my cat, Skelly, who is firmly camped out just below the microphone.
We actually have two special guests, because Dessa's back there. see that little bun?
There's a baby bun on the podcast! These are our silent partners, really.
Sometimes she's not silent and you're, like, talking, and she's just, like, throwing shit around her, like, crate. And I have to, I go in and I cut out that part of my audio while you're talking so that it's not over you.
Well, that's very kind of you. My New Year's resolution for the podcast is to not be such a fidgety bitch and, like, make so much accidental ambient noise that you have to audit it out constantly.
Oh, that's fine.
Well.
We're here.
We're here. Like,
we're doing this.
Well, you know, I just want you to know that I'm gonna try. I want everyone to know I'm trying.
That's fine. I'm gonna try not to be so nervous when I read.
You always try. You sound good. You always, like, sound very, like...
I get... It's so funny. If I'm, like, reading something aloud to myself or to Justin, I'm, like, fine. But on the podcast, I stumble a lot. And I'm just like, if you just relax a little, you'll be fine.
I feel like there. I do, too. We both will get there. The one today, I was polishing my topic for this episode, and I was at work, and I had some, you know, time when it was just me in the store, and so I was, like, practicing reading it aloud when the store was empty, and then someone would come in, and I would be like, ugh, like, stop talking, like, hi, how can I help you? Let me know if you need anything.
It's like me listening to my audiobook in the store, or in the office. I suddenly became you. In the office, and, like, as soon as somebody comes in, I, like, slam the pause button, and I'm like, hi! How can I help you?
What's up? Yeah. Do you have anything holiday special that you wanna... Everything? Do you have a good holiday? Good New Year's?
You know, I survived it.
You know, sometimes that's the best you can hope for.
Yeah, I got to see my fam, so that was good. What about you?
I feel like I literally survived it because, as you know, I was, like, sick as a dog for, like, that whole week. I was ready to die, but I'm feeling a lot better now, thankfully.
Not to blame you or throw you under the bus, but that is part of why we didn't do a post-mortem, because she was super sick, and we were just like, man, it's the holiday, I'm just gonna let this one slide.
Yeah, sometimes you gotta.
Yeah.
But look, we came back this time.
I also had, like, one small housekeeping thing to say.
Ooh, yes.
If sometimes it sounds like we're, like, talking over each other, or we're like, it is because we are not in the same room, and we are doing a Discord call, so sometimes you're hearing my voice real time, and you're hearing her voice real time, but we're not hearing each other's voices real time.
Yes.
So we're not just, like, always yelling over each other. It is an honest mistake. But sometimes there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah, see? Sometimes it feels that... Yeah, it feels that way because I feel like I'm responding to you in a conversational manner. But I know it doesn't always work that way in recording.
Both ways, like... we'll just start... Like, wait, no, oh, you, no, you go. Because we don't immediately know that the other person has said anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it probably will never get fixed, because we are, you know, we do this at a distance. So that's all I wanted to say.
No, I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you for mentioning it.
Now we have another special guest, which is the corgi.
They just keep coming, you guys.
Yeah. We have a lot of animals.
So do you want to go first, or should I go first? We've been kind of, like, building up to yours, so I don't know if that means, like, we should save it for last, or if we should kick off with it.
Well, I did go first last time.
Oh, good point. Okay.
But if you want me to go first, I'm ready to.
I can go first.
You go for it.
I'm going to go first. So my topic today was when we got an email of suggestions from someone named James. Thank you, James. We're going to probably be working our way through some of these suggestions over time. But I wanted to go ahead and jump in on one right away. So... this is a listener request. And today I'm going to be talking about the Yuba County Five. Are you familiar with this story?
I am not. I saw it in the email. There were a lot of really good suggestions, so thanks, James.
Yes, thank
but
you.
But no, I didn't research it.
Well, I did, so you don't have to. I feel like I over-researched this topic, as I do almost every topic, but maybe it'll, like, blow through pretty quickly. We'll see. So this case has been referred to as the American Dyatlov Pass, which, if you're not familiar with the Dyatlov Pass incident, there is a lot of really good coverage of it out there already. I've talked about maybe doing a postmortem about it at some point, just to give you like a short and sweet rundown if this is something you've not heard of. But suffice to say, the Dyatlov Pass incident is one where a bunch of like otherwise like young, strong, healthy people ended up dying horrific deaths under unexplained circumstances. And that is very much the kind of thing that happened in this case as well. This event happened in February of 1978 in like northern-ish California, and concerns a group of five men who all lived in and around like the Yuba City and Marysville area. This is a little bit north of Sacramento, if I remember correctly. So if that kind of like gives you a geographic location in your brain. The five men were named Bill Sterling, who was 29, Jack Hewitt, age 24, Ted Weir, 32, Jack Madruga, 30, and Gary Mathias, who was 25. All five of the men lived with mild to moderate mental or psychiatric issues and had met through something called Gateway Projects, which was an organization for adults with special needs in the like local community. In one of the articles I read, it was kind of unclear whether any of the young men ever had their disabilities formally diagnosed, except for Matthias, which I will get to eventually. So with that being said, I can't speak reliably as to like what exactly their status was. In some of the news articles of the time, they were like referred to as like mentally slow, or they used the R word, which I hate and I'm not gonna say. But this is kind of how these men were referred to. So I'm also going to take this, I guess this is as good a place to mention it as any. I'm going to introduce this idea with a big like asterisk because I read it in one like relatively recent two-part article, but I didn't see it like all over the place. So I'm hesitant to like get too into it, but I've seen it kind of suggested that Sterling, Hewitt, Weir, and Madruga were like really tightly knit, with Matthias maybe being a little bit more of an outsider to the four other guys, but they're all friends as far as I could tell. And this is something else I'm going to touch on later in the story. I guess I'm kind of kicking this off with trying to talk about the men individually as they were alive. Because, you know, they were people. There's this implication that Matthias's specific issues may have stemmed from developing drug problems during army service in West Germany in the early 70s, which led to him eventually being diagnosed with schizophrenia and being discharged from the military. And I guess this is relevant because it might be more like he had a mental health issue as opposed to, say, like an intellectual disability, like the other men. And I'm honestly not sure if it even matters, but it seemed worth mentioning that that might be relevant based on some of the things that I read. I also don't know if it's accurate to say that I truly do not know if it's accurate to say that something like schizophrenia can be caused by drug abuse, because that's what is implied by some of the things that I read. And so, go ahead.
It's not like a cause, but it can be activated by.
Okay, so thank you for like clearing that up, because I have very little knowledge of the effects of like different kinds of drugs or medications on the human brain, because I am way too white bread and vanilla to be doing hard drugs, and I feel like any knowledge I have on something like that is very like LSD, MK Ultra stuff that's like super steeped in like weirdo conspiracy theories, probably not super accurate. So as far as anything like that goes, please don't take anything I have to say with regards to the idea that drugs like, quote, gave him his schizophrenia as like something I'm saying. I bring it up because that seems like what so many articles that I read like implied, that his drug problems gave him schizophrenia, and I'm just not sure that that's the case.
I know of two people that I actually know that it was the case, that it was activated by drug use. One of them was speed, the other one was LSD.
Okay.
But like I said, I don't believe that it causes it. I just think it can activate it or bring out the symptoms of it.
That makes a lot more sense to me. So that, I guess all of that to say, that was something that I kind of got a lot from some of these articles, but I think it may be what they meant was activated it and not caused it. So getting back to the rest of the group, all of these men were sort of collectively referred to as like the boys by others in their community, their friends and their family. All of them still lived with their parents. Matthias, after being discharged from the military, he supplemented his army disability pay by working in his stepfather's gardening business. And he had been a singer in a local band and played football at Marysville High School when he was younger in the late 60s. Madruga worked as a dishwasher at a dried fruit company, and he helped Sterling land a job there, although he was eventually fired from that job by being unable to use new dishwashing equipment. Sterling had worked previously at Beale Air Force Base as a dishwasher, but his mother made him quit after discovering that airmen routinely got him drunk to steal his money, which is very fucked up. Weir loved making new friends but lacked basic common sense, his brother Dallas said in an interview with the Sacramento Bee. He once spent $100 on pencils for no particular reason, his parents told investigators, and would question instructions as simple as stopping at a stop sign. In one story, when his parents' house in the town of Linda caught fire, he stayed in bed watching the ceiling over him burn and told his brothers to leave him alone because he needed to rest for work the next day. Hewitt was the most severely handicapped of the five, his father told investigators. He couldn't read, write, or dial a telephone, and depended highly on his mother and Weir, whom he had known for about 8 years. He was shy with the speech impediment, and he didn't particularly like being away from home for extended periods of time. Certainly not overnight, his father said. The five men's favorite leisure activity was sports. The family said when they got together, it was usually to play a game or to like watch one on TV, and they played basketball together as the Gateway Gators, which was a team sponsored by a local program for the mentally handicapped. So these guys spent a lot of time together. They were obviously like pretty close knit. They were involved in each other's work life, home life, and their free time. On February 25th, the Gators were due to play their first game in a week-long tournament sponsored by the Special Olympics, for which the winners would get a free week in Los Angeles with a chance to meet All in the Family actress Sally Struthers. I have not thought about All in the Family since a million years ago.
Struthers is not a name that you hear anymore.
I know. That's very much like something I think about my grandparents when I think about. But the five men had prepared the night before, some even laying out their uniforms and asking their parents to wake them up on time. Like, they were really stoked on it, like, really prepared. This game meant a lot to them and was, like, a huge deal for them to have this opportunity to participate in. Matthias in particular was adamant that his mother not let him oversleep. They decided to drive to Chico that night to cheer on the UC Davis basketball team in an away game against Chico State. Madruga, who was the only member of the group besides Matthias who had a driver's license, drove the group 50 miles north to Chico in his turquoise and white 1969 Mercury Montego. The men wore only light coats against the cool temperatures in the upper Sacramento Valley at night at that time of year. After the Davis team won the game, the group got back into Madruga's car and drove a short distance from the Chico State campus to a place like a little like shop called Bear's Market in downtown Chico, where they bought snacks along with sodas and cartons of milk to drink. Just like a snack run, because they had like an hour-ish drive back home. It was shortly before the store's 10 p.m. closing time. The clerk later remembered them because she resented that such a large group had come in and delayed her from starting the process of closing, which, same. Yeah, I feel you. We've all been there. However, this was the last time the boys were ever seen alive again. At their homes, some of the men's parents had stayed up to make sure that they returned, which they did not do. Ted Weir's mother woke up afraid at 5 a.m. the next morning, the Washington Post reported. She immediately called Bill Sterling's mother, who had been up since 2 a.m. and had already spoken to the Hewitts, and at this point, they decided it was time to notify the police. So, authorities in Butte and Yuba counties began searching along the route that the men took from there to Chico, and they found no sign of them, but a few days later, a Plumas National Forest Ranger... I hope I said that right. Plumas National Forest Ranger told investigators that he had seen the Montego parked along the Oroville-Quincy Road in the forest on February 25th. At the time, he had not considered it significant, since many residents often drove up there into the Sierra Nevada on winter weekends to go, like, cross-country skiing and stuff like that, because there was a really extensive trail system up there. But after he read the missing persons bulletin, he recognized the car and led the deputies to it a few days later on February 28th. Inside the car was evidence suggesting that the men had been in it between when they were last seen and when it was abandoned. There were, like, empty wrappers and, like, empty cartons and cans from the store that they had been at in Chico, along with programs from the basketball game they had watched and a neatly folded road map of California. But this also, like, raised a lot more questions than it answered, because obviously, like, they had been there, they'd eaten, they had a map, so they knew where they were going, presumably.
I mean, I can't read a fucking map, but I'm pretty sure back then everyone could.
I was gonna say, it reminds me of a little bit when I first got my driver's license and I had my first car, and my dad, like, packed a, like, road map of my tiny hometown into the trunk of the car, God. Like, just in case I ever needed it. And I, like, was like, Dad, I cannot use this. I'm so sorry to be, like, a stupid millennial, but I, like, cannot use this. But it's just, yeah, you're right.
My mom did similar.
But, yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, I presume at that time, reading a map was, like, a really common skill. Like,
oh, yeah. Everybody
a very
did.
Basic skill. So, they did have a map. And they had definitely, like, been in the car for some time at that point. So the first kind of question that's raised at this point is the actual location of the car, which is 70 miles from where they were last spotted in Chico, far off, like, far off any direct route to Yuba City or Marysville. None of the men's families could speculate as to why they might have driven up a long and winding dirt road on a winter night deep into a high elevation, like, super remote forest, especially not without any extra clothing on, and, like, certainly not on the night before a huge basketball game that they had been talking excitedly about amongst themselves for weeks. Madruga's parents said that he did not like the cold weather and had never been up into the mountains at any point. Sterling's father had once taken his son kind of, like, sort of up in that area, near where the car was found, for, like, a fishing weekend at some point, but he had not enjoyed it, and in the future, when his father took trips up there, he chose to remain at home, so...
Yeah, because fishing sucks.
Let's not do fishing. So, even though there's kind of the idea that, like, maybe one of the men had been in that area once before, in the past, he had no reason to be, like, familiar with that area. Similarly, the police could not figure out why the men had abandoned the car. They had reached 4,400 feet in elevation along the road, which is, like, about where the snow line was at that time of year, and just short of where the road was closed for the winter. Like, had they gone any further up, they would have had to turn back anyway because the road would have been closed. The car had become stuck in some snowdrifts, and there was evidence that the wheels had been spun attempting to get it out. But the snow was not so deep or, like, hard packed in or anything that five healthy young men would not have been able to push it out. Like, yeah. They totally, like, could have gotten out of, they weren't, it wasn't wrecked. It was just kind of, like, off the road.
I'm patiently waiting to, like, hear what else you have to say, but I'm just like, well, then what the fuck happened?
I know, exactly, right? So, the keys were not present, suggesting at first that the car had been abandoned because it might not have been functioning properly, with maybe, like, the intention of returning later with help. But when police hotwired the car, it started immediately, and the gas tank was a quarter full, so it's not like they were out of gas either. So the questions continued after the police towed the car back to the station for a more thorough examination. The few roads that snake like that into the Plumas National Forest are, like, really rough and bumpy. They're mostly frequented by loggers' trucks these days. And rescue vehicles actually used during the search incurred, like, a pretty moderate amount of damage. Yet the Montego, which is a, like, kind of like a big, heavy, old-school type car, even before you count the fact that there are 5 grown men in it, it had barely any scratches on its undercarriage, no dents, no gouges, no mud, no scrapes. There wasn't even, like, any damage to the muffler, which on that type of car is, like, really, like, low-hanging. So either the driver had been very careful, or it was someone familiar with the road, which is a familiarity that Madruga was not known to have, nor, his family said, would he have let someone else drive the car. He was, like, very protective and, like, proud of his car. So he, again, also being one of the only men that even could drive, like, it's really unlikely he would pass the car off. But the car was unlocked and had a window rolled down when it was found. And they said they felt like it was unlike him to leave the car unsecured like that. Mm-hmm. Efforts to search the vicinity were hampered by a severe snowstorm. And 2 days later, after searchers and snowcats nearly got lost themselves, further efforts were called off due to the weather. And no trace of the men was found other than the car. Not ever. Okay. No, you're good. You're good. You're just sucked in,
I'm all on the edge.
So, in response to local media coverage of the case, police received reports of some or even all of the men being sighted after they had left Chico. Reports of them being seen elsewhere in California, or sometimes even, like, elsewhere in the country. Most of the reports were easily dismissed, but there were two that kind of stood out to police. One of them, I'm going to try my best with this guy's name. It was Joseph Shones of Sacramento, told police that he inadvertently wound up spending the night of February 24th and into the 25th near where the Montego was found. He had driven up there because he had a cabin up there, and he was there to, like, check out the cabin and the snowpack in advance of a weekend ski trip for his family. So at 5:30 p.m., about 150 feet up the road from where the Montego was found, he too got stuck in the snow. And in the process of trying to free it, he realized he was beginning to experience the early symptoms of a heart attack and got back in his car to keep and, like, kept the engine running so he could have heat. 6 hours later, lying in the car and experiencing severe pain. Can you see this?
Yes.
We have the cat, the special guest. She is really getting involved. 6 hours later, lying in the car and experiencing severe pain, he told police he saw headlights coming up behind him, and looking out, he saw a car parked behind him, headlights on, with a group of people around it, one of which seemed to him to be a woman holding a baby, which is weird. He called out to them for help, but when he called out, they stopped talking and turned out the headlights altogether. And then some time passed. He saw more lights come from behind him, this time flashlights. Still having a heart attack, he called out for help, and the flashlights went out again. So, like, whoever was out there was, like, doing their best to not be noticed or not be acknowledged by this person. After that, Sean said at first, he recalled a pickup truck parking 20 feet behind him briefly and then continuing down the road. But later he clarified that he could not be sure of that since at the time he was almost delirious from the pain he was in.
Yeah.
So, which is understandable. I can't be too mad about that. After Sean's car finally ran out of gas in the early morning hours, his pain subsided enough for him to walk 8 miles down the road to a lodge where the manager drove him back home. And at that time, they passed the abandoned Montego at the point where he recalled hearing the voices originate from. Doctors later confirmed that he had, like, indeed experienced a mild heart attack. And Weir's mother said that ignoring someone's pleas for help was not like her son, if indeed he had been present. And recalled how he and Sterling had helped someone they knew get to the hospital after overdosing on Valium. So, if it's clear that if they had been there and they had heard someone calling out for help, assuming someone didn't prevent them from doing so, they would have been inclined to help somebody in need.
So, how long after was that? You said it, but...
The man pulled over because he was getting, like, sick and having a heart attack at 5:30 p.m.?
Like, between them going missing and this. Or is it the same night?
It's the same night.
Okay.
So he's, like, pulled over. He's having a heart attack at around 5:30 p.m. The boys were last seen alive at 10 p.m. in that town. Mm-hmm. And he is saying that 6 hours after he first pulled over and is experiencing this pain and symptoms,
he saw some people.
He saw some people. He called out for help. They acted in a weird way. And that kind of lines up because, mm-hmm. you know, what, 6 hours later would have been around sometime after 11 p.m. And if mm-hmm. they left that drugstore or whatever at like 10 p.m. and they were on the road for a while, like, those hours kind of line up.
Yeah.
From my own Google Maps research, that sounds like it might work. The other notable report was from a woman who worked at a store in the small hamlet of Brownsville, which is 30 miles from the spot where the car had been abandoned, which they could have reached had they continued down the road from where they left the car. So, like, if they had abandoned the car and they had kept walking, it's 30 miles away, but it's on that road, so they would have gotten there eventually. On March 3rd, the woman saw flyers that had been distributed with the men's picture and information about the reward that the families had put up. And she called the police and told deputies that four of them had stopped at the store in a red pickup truck 2 days after the disappearance. And the store owner corroborated her account. The woman said she identified the men immediately as from out of the area due to, quote, their big eyes and facial expressions, which I kind of don't know what that means, but... okay.
Maybe they just seemed lost.
Or really naive or
mm-hmm.
out of their element, maybe. She actually identified two of the men specifically as Hewitt and Sterling. And she said she saw them in the phone booth outside while the other two went inside. Police really did, you know, they felt like she was a very credible witness and they took her account very seriously. And at this point, the store owner kind of came forward with some of the additional details. He told investigators that the men, who he believed to be Weir and Hewitt, came in and bought burritos, chocolate milk, and soft drinks. Weir's brother told the Los Angeles Times that while driving to Brownsville in a different car in apparent ignorance of the basketball game seemed completely out of character for them. However, the owner's description of the two men's behavior seemed consistent. Describing Weir as someone that would eat anything he could get his hands on. And also he noted that Weir was often accompanied by Hewitt more than any of the other four. So for those two to be together, kind of paired off, made sense. However, Hewitt's brother said that Jack hated using the telephone to the point that, like, if any of the other boys called, like, he would handle the phone call because he just, like, couldn't and wouldn't get on the phone. So for him to be in the phone booth was maybe kind of weird.
Yeah.
So some things kind of add up here. Maybe some things don't. With the evidence not pointing to any clear conclusion about what happened that night that the men disappeared, police and the families were not ruling out the possibility that the men had met with foul play, which, like, kind of seems reasonable given what witnesses reported. My first thought was maybe someone followed them for some reason or, like, forced them off the road, like, tried to rob them. Like, I don't know, like... But although the, like, woman holding a baby thing is kind of weird to me, the fact that both reports mention a pickup truck, you know, maybe they were kidnapped or otherwise forced to leave the car against their will, but, like, why? You know,
there's... Right, there's, and then they were missing some people, too.
Exactly. So there's still, like, a lot of questions, even though things kind of seem like, maybe this is answered, but then what about this? Eventually, the discovery of 4 of the 5 men's bodies seemed to suggest not foul play. But again, we're raising even more questions about what happened and what happened to the 5th person. So, getting into the discovery of the bodies. On June 4th, so we're looking at a little over 3 months after the men went missing, most of the higher elevation snow at this point has melted off. So a group of motorcyclists were out for, like, a ride, and they stopped at a trailer that was maintained by the Forest Service at a campsite off the road about 19.4 miles from where the Montego had been found. A front window on the trailer had been broken, and when they opened the door, they were overcome by the odor of what turned out to be a decaying body inside, later identified as Weir's body. So searchers returned to Plumas following the road between the trail and the site of the Montego. The next day, they found remains, later identified as Madruga and Sterling, on opposite sides of a road. So one's on this side, one's on that side of the road. They are 11.4 miles from where the car had been. The former's body had been partially consumed by scavenging animals. Only bones remained of the latter, scattered over a small area. Autopsies showed that they had both died of hypothermia. Deputies speculated that one may have succumbed to the desire for sleep that marks the condition's final stages, and the other refused to leave his side, eventually meeting the same fate, which is, like, the saddest fucking thing that I have thought of in recent memory. Yeah. So, 2 days later, searchers found 3 Forest Service blankets and a rusted flashlight by the road. Could not be determined how long those items had been there, so we don't definitively know whether or not the boys used them, since Gary Mathias, who is the missing person, had presumably not taken his medication. Pictures of him were distributed to mental institutions all over California. However, no trace of him has ever been found to this day. Weir's body was on a bed with 8 sheets wrapped around it, including the head. The autopsy showed that he had died of a combination of starvation and hypothermia. He had lost nearly half his 200 pounds, and the growth of his beard suggested he had lived as long as 13 weeks from when he had last shaved.
Wow.
That seems like such a long time. That's 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he would have died pretty recently, like, mm-hmm. just before he was found. His feet were badly frostbitten, almost gangrenous.
Yeah.
So, gross.
How did he even survive?
No idea. That is a really long time.
Like, how many snacks did they buy?
I know, right? Well, hold that thought. On the table next to the bed were some of his personal effects, including his wallet with cash, a nickel ring with his name, Ted, engraved on it, and a gold necklace that he also wore. Because it was the 70s, you know. Mm-hmm. Also on the table was a gold watch without its crystal, which Weir's family said was not his, and a partially melted candle. He was wearing a velour shirt and lightweight pants, but his shoes could not be found. Most puzzling to the investigators was how Weir had come to his fate. No fire had been set in the trailer's fireplace, despite an ample supply of matches and paperback novels to use as kindling. Heavy forestry clothing, which could have kept the men warm, also remained where it was stored. A dozen sea ration cans from the storage shed outside had been opened, and their contents had been consumed, but a locker in the same shed that held an even greater assortment of dehydrated foods, enough to keep all 5 men fed for a year if that had been necessary, had not even been opened. Similarly, another shed nearby held a butane tank with a valve that, had it been opened, would have fed the trailer's heating system. However, this behavior was consistent with what Weir's family members described as his lack of common sense. See again, not understanding why you stop at a stop sign, that kind of thing. It also seemed that Weir had not been alone in the trailer, and that Matthias and possibly Hewitt had been there with him. Matthias's tennis sneakers were in the trailer, and the sea rations that I mentioned before had been opened with a P-38 can opener, which Matthias would have learned how to use during his army service. Matthias, his feet perhaps also swollen from frostbite, could have decided to put on Weir's shoes instead, if he had chosen to venture outside, which would explain why his shoes were missing. The sheets all over Weir's body also suggested that one of the others had been there with him, as his gangrenous feet would have been in too much pain for him to pull them over the body, or over his body, like, by himself. So, even knowing that four of the five men had died in the Sierra, investigators still could not completely explain what had led to those deaths. They still found no explanation for why the men were there in the first place, although they learned that Matthias had friends in the small town of Forbestown, and police believed it was possible that he made an attempt to visit them on the way back home, and the men may have taken a wrong turn near Oroville that put them on that mountain road. But for whatever reason, the men had left the Montego, and they had, instead of going back down to the road, where they would have passed the lodge that Shanes, the guy with the heart attack, the lodge that he was returned to after he, like, stopped having a heart attack, basically, it continued going in that in the direction that they were originally going. So, again, when they, like, left the car, had they just, like, turned around and gone back to the road, they would have hit that lodge and been in civilization and with people. And they, like, kept going up this mountain, apparently. Purposeful motion like that is not consistent with the circular patterns traveled by those who genuinely believe themselves to be lost.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the day before the men went missing, there had been a Forest Service snowcat that had kind of gone along the road in that direction to clear snow off of that trailer roof so that it wouldn't collapse. And the police believe it's possible that the group had decided to follow those tracks through snowdrifts 4 to 6 feet high to wherever they led in the belief that shelter was not too far away. Madruga and Sterling probably succumbed to hypothermia midway along the long walk to that trailer. So that's why their bodies were left out on the road. It is assumed that once they found the trailer, the other three broke the window to enter. And since it was locked, they may have believed it was private property and may have feared arrest for theft if they used anything that they found there. After Weir died, or the others believed he had, they perhaps chose to attempt to return to civilization by different routes, overland, on foot. And this is kind of like the most common theory that I've seen kind of posited around, although the more recent article I mentioned before, the like two-part one that I kind of touched on way back at the beginning, kind of entertains the idea that Matthias may have been the one to kill the other four, or otherwise be responsible for the situation they ended up in. And this is kind of where we get heavily into the state of Matthias specifically's, like, mental well-being. So this article was posted, I think, in, like, February of 2019. So this is, like, a pretty recent, like, take on this case. According to this article, and again, we're getting into, like, kind of this one guy's history here, Matthias was first placed in a psychiatric ward as a sophomore in high school following a bad hallucinogenic trip, his parents told investigators. And this is in opposition to the four other men whose intellectual disabilities, like, manifested in childhood. He consistently used drugs throughout his service in the U.S. Army in the early 1970s, which I mentioned before. His service in the Army included a medal for sharpshooting, an AWOL arrest, and the eventual medical discharge for the paranoid schizophrenia. And this was according to the sheriff's files. While in sheriff's custody, after his AWOL arrest in February 1973, Matthias called two sergeants and a deputy to his cell, according to case files. When they opened his cell, he walked into the hallway stark naked and punched one of the sergeants in the face, sending blood spilling from his mouth and nose. He tried to hit the other sergeant as well, but was subdued. Quote, "I've been in the Army and I don't like it, and I thought if I hit a cop, maybe they'd let me out," he told investigators at the time. And he later received the medical discharge, so I guess he ultimately got his wish.
Yeah, it's one way to do it, I suppose.
Yeah. That same month, Matthias was watching TV at his cousin's house around 8:30 a.m. while the cousin's 17-year-old wife slept groggily from medication used to cope with an ongoing illness. The cousin went to check on Matthias after a bathroom break turned suspiciously long and allegedly found him straddling the woman, groping her breasts as she lay nearly motionless in her underwear. The cousin asked Matthias what he was doing, to which he allegedly replied that he wanted to kiss the woman. When the cousin said he was calling 911, Matthias allegedly responded, "Good, I want to go back to jail." Matthias pleaded guilty to a battery of a peace officer for the jail incident, and a second charge of assault with the intent to rape was dropped as the result of his plea deal, a local newspaper reported at the time.
Ain't that just the way?
Yuba County Superior Court employees are still unable to find the details of Matthias' sentence. Under current California law, he could have faced up to 3 years in prison if convicted of battery of a peace officer, and 9 years for assault with the intent to rape. But Matthias was out within 8 months. In his next run-in with law enforcement that December, police had evidence he visited the home of a couple he knew after shooting methamphetamine and dropping bennies. Or for people like me, that means swallowing tablets of the amphetamine benzodrine. Matthias was acting erratically, talking about how he wanted to stab a woman in the jaw, the couple told police. After he told their 3-year-old daughter, "I thought I'd kill you once, I guess I'll have to do it again," the man and woman reportedly kicked Matthias out of their house and watched as he pounded on locked doors until police arrived. Court records do not indicate he served any jail time in connection with this incident. He had other run-ins with the law. There was an arrest on suspicion of grand theft auto, a citation for disturbing the peace, and once for driving without a license, where he allegedly told the arresting officer, "Fuck you, cops, you are all motherfuckers." A slew of bar fights, and there were complaints that he was prowling at a local cemetery. So, as an investigator at the Yuba Sheriff's Office put it at the time of his disappearance, Matthias was known to the department. Drugs had warped Matthias's brain, said Gary Whiteley, who started dating Matthias's sister Sharon in 1967. He later married her and was going through divorce proceedings when the boys went missing. So this is more or less a family member at the time. Whiteley and Matthias had spent summer afternoons near the end of high school drinking beer and swimming with their friends, but when the two reconnected after their military service, where Whiteley had been in Vietnam and Matthias had been in Germany, he said Matthias was largely in and out of his family's home and not mentally stable at that point. So, after being picked up by Stockton police in 1974, Matthias was admitted to a nearby state mental hospital. He spent 2 days there before crawling out through a drain pipe and walking and hitchhiking back to Marysville, still wearing his hospital pajamas, according to case files. It was a daring but familiar escape. Matthias had previously sneaked out of Letterman Army Hospital's psychiatric ward in San Francisco and later walked away from another mental health facility in 1975. In 1975, with a short stint at Yuba College proving unsuccessful, Matthias abruptly left school and moved to Oregon to stay with his grandmother. His mother and stepfather, Ida and Robert Klopf, finally reached him on the phone weeks later and pleaded with him to come back to Yuba County, and he hung up on them. And the Klopfs didn't hear from Matthias until he showed up on their doorstep 5 weeks later, ragged and filthy. He had walked from Portland, Oregon, to Marysville, stealing milk off porches and eating dog food to stay alive on the 540-mile trek. Later that year, a Yuba County couple awoke to find Matthias standing in their bedroom, according to case files. He had punched through the window and unlocked their front door, and now was looking for a ring to return to Satan, the couple told police. When the couple asked why he was there, he said they were in his house, and he was there to collect the rent.
That would be, like, just so, such a gross situation to have to deal with.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. So, at this point, Matthias is known to have strained out because he started to take medication for his schizophrenia. So, while on his medication, he was able to hold down a job with his stepfather's gardening business. He had no notable contact with the police during the 2 years leading up to his disappearance. And family members said that he had not, quote, gone haywire after that. So, at this point, he's joining the Gateway Projects. He started hanging out with Sterling, Weir, Madruga, and Hewitt a few months before the boys went missing. There's kind of a list here of the different drugs that he was on at the time. However, the basketball coach told investigators that he, didn't feel comfortable around Matthias. He, described it as saying that he felt he could, quote, possibly flip out at any time. This particular program that they were involved in, Gateway, has been closed for decades, and its leaders from the time are dead, leaving the question of how Matthias got involved in the first place kind of a mystery. Jack Beecham, who was the former Yuba County Sheriff, says he doesn't know how Matthias got into this program. Following a 1978 interview with Matthias's longtime acquaintance, Janet Inzera, Yuba County Sergeant James Black wrote that Matthias had repeatedly told Inzera of a dream where he and several other people would disappear. Inzera called Matthias a violent person, hurting several men seriously, and said that he also hates women, according to these interview notes. As with a lot of people who we might hear about in cases like this, he had a really not good family history. His father was abusive. His mother took her and the kids and ran off, eventually got a restraining order to get the dad away from all of them. They kind of believe that mental instability ran in the family. There was a lot of, suicide and stuff like that. So I guess all of this history is meant to inform us that, maybe he had a tendency towards violent behavior. But even in this article, it states that once he was regularly on antipsychotics for those 2 years, his physicians considered him to be one of their most sterling success cases.
But so he might have been off his meds during that time.
Right.
Had to have been.
He almost certainly had to have been. So.
And especially if you go off of those kind of medications suddenly, your symptoms can come back really intensely.
And that's kind of something that is mentioned in here. There's kind of, they wonder if maybe he intentionally didn't take his medication the night before this big game because some of its side effects included drowsiness, lethargy, and dizziness. And maybe he thought, I want to be in peak form for this really important game. I'm going to skip my meds today. I don't know. If he had taken it, they were out there so long, it's not like he would have had it.
Yeah, anyway. I feel like one day wouldn't have been enough for him to completely go nuts. Sorry, that sounds insensitive. One day wouldn't have been enough for him to really start experiencing symptoms right away. But I don't know.
But 12 or 13 weeks?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, which is, that's how long we know the one guy survived for.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. So, and he obviously, had a good amount of stamina if he could make all these, hospital escape attempts, if he could walk from Portland 540 miles to get home over 5 weeks, there's kind of an idea that, so about 3 weeks after they went missing, a Yuba City woman named Debbie Lynn Reese picked up the telephone, says hello, and a voice on the other line says, I know where the missing 5 men are. Hangs up. Man called back the next day, says, I need help because I really hurt those guys bad. When she asks, who did you hurt? He replied, don't play dumb with me, and hung up.
Oh.
There was one more call the next day, which was on March 17th. And the person on the other line said, "Those five guys are all dead." She says, "They're all dead?" "They're all dead," he repeated. And then he hung up, and she never received any more phone calls again. The one kind of thing is that the police, you know, they definitely think, like, it's possible he was off his meds, something went really wrong. But their kind of only hesitation is that, like, even when he would go on these, like, long walkabouts, when he, like, would kind of, like, go off the grid, he always returned home. And so they are like, yeah, but, you know, wouldn't he have come home eventually? Like, even if he did hurt or kill, or even if he didn't, like, flat outright kill these guys, if he, like, was the reason that they were in the situation to begin with. Like, if he, you know, he's the one who had that friend that lived on in another town. If he had been the one who was like, let's stop over in this town and see my friend, and everything else that happened after that was an accident. Like, even if he was kind of responsible for it in that way, like, wouldn't he have eventually made his way back home?
Somebody who is ill, though, doesn't see the accident thing.
That's true. Like,
potentially the same way. He may have been seeing it from a perspective of, well, I can never come home now.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, too. So, he's never been found. There is no evidence he died, but there's no evidence he's still alive either. Those phone calls could have been a prank.
Yeah, it could have been some kid.
You know, this was a really highly publicized case at the time that eventually made, like, national news. So it's not as if somebody couldn't have, you know. I feel personally, like, a little bit torn as far as, like, Matthias, the guy who's still missing, is, because it sounds like he really did, like, have a history of, like, inappropriate and violent behaviors. Mm-hmm. But I also, I felt like when I was reading these articles, they kind of smacked a little bit of this, like, fear of people that have mental illnesses. Yeah. That kind of, do you know what I mean? That kind of, like, made me feel uncomfortable too. And I particularly feel like that might have been a case in the late 70s. You know,
but it really, like, does depend on the illness, and it depends on the severity of the individual. Because, I mean, some of them can be really scary and really bad.
Yeah. So, I just don't know how to feel. Like, a part of me wants to have sympathy for him, but I have no reason to, I don't know, believe that he, you know, couldn't have flipped out in some way in not being on his meds. And it's honestly, it's just, like, a really, like, tragic, heartbreaking situation all around, because ultimately, like,
it was a bunch of special needs people, not, you know, on from all around, kind of all in this really bad situation where they apparently, none of them realized how to get out of it.
Yeah. And it's real sad. It's just real sad. So, that is the story of the Yuba County Five.
So what do you guys think happened? Let us know.
Yes. If you have information on the whereabouts of Karen Thais. Yeah.
I mean, seriously, though, if you do, like, let's hear it.
Yeah. Honestly, he still has, like, a brother and, like, family members. In one of the articles I read that was, like, it said, like, and this was so sad. It was, like, the only update that is ever made to this case anymore is when his brother, every once in a while, they send him, like, a form, and he has to, like, check a mark that says, like, yes, my brother's still missing. And that's, like, the only thing. And that's really sad also. These people still have, like, family around, you know?
Yeah.
If we can figure out what happened, everyone can get some closure.
So, mine is, like, less sad, but also very, like, very spooky, and it's also very long, so I'm sorry, you guys. You guys can feel free to listen to this in two parts.
I'm ready.
All right. Have you ever heard of Gary Sudbrink?
No, I don't
Good.
Think so.
All right. Good. All right. In 1993, okay, first of all, I need to source this. I found out about this because it came up on Unresolved Mysteries. There is not a lot of good information on it in general anywhere on the internet. And this is a really good post. And it was by user Peanut, like P-N-U-T underscore butter jelly. Nice. And they posted it a month ago, and they changed my life for the, probably the worst.
For the worst?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Okay. So, in 1993, Gary Sudbrink was a 27-year-old Air Force captain originally from Long Island, New York, assigned to a medical pharmacy work in San Antonio, Texas. In February of that same year, he planned an unannounced surprise post-holiday trip to visit his friends and family back home. After arriving at his parents' house in Long Island, Gary placed a call to a longtime friend, Mike, to tell him that he was home and to see about making holiday plans to get together. But when Mike answered, he was confused. He told Gary that he had already spoken to him the day before on a call where Gary, or someone who sounded just like him, had told Mike he was home and that he'd just flown in through LaGuardia Airport, although Gary had actually come in through JFK, and that he was coming down with a cold, even though Gary was perfectly healthy at the time, so they wouldn't be able to get together.
What the fuck?
As the two of them called, another call came in through call waiting. With his parents still present in the room, Gary picked up the other line, and a deep mechanical voice greeted him. Instinctively, for whatever reason, Gary pressed record on the nearby answering machine in an attempt to document it. So here are the calls. So I'm going to send you the link to the first call.
Yes. I'll tell you who it is.
Hello?
Yeah. Do you want to speak to him?
It's Gary. Sudbrink there.
Yeah, who's this? Steven, are you playing games with me or what? Huh? Steven, if you're playing games, I'm going to kick your ass.
So how long are you going to be back from Texas?
Huh?
You're being impersonated by the other voice.
Yeah, this is you, Steven, you idiot. You're pissing me off. Jerk. I'm going to get you on... Let's see what it says. Review. One new call out of area. Is Steven out of the area?
How long are you going to be back from Texas?
Wait, say that again?
You're being impersonated by the other voice.
Wait, hold on. Is Steven out of the calling area or what? What do you mean you don't know? He's in Queens.
Well, who are you talking?
I don't know who the fuck.
Hello?
Hello?
Is Gary Sudbrink there?
Who is this? Sounds like a robot.
So hello?
How long are you going to be back from Texas?
What was that again, sir?
You're being impersonated by the other voice.
No, be quiet, Alf, huh? Sorry, would you see that again? Hello? Being impersonated by what voice?
Hello?
Yeah. Hello?
Is Gary Sudbrink there?
Yeah, hold on a second. Yeah, what is your question? I'll answer it.
So how long are you going to be back from Texas?
How long?
You're being impersonated by the other voice.
Right. When am I coming back? Is that your question? Okay, there was a break. Hold on. You want to know when I'm coming back to Texas? Oh, is that your question?
So how long are you going to be back from Texas?
How long am I going to be back from Texas? That question doesn't make any sense.
By the other voice.
Okay. I'll be coming back eventually. I can't tell you when. You should know that question, the answer to the question, because you seem to know more about me than I do. You know what I'm saying?
Are you an intergalactic person?
Are you a space alien? Sounds like he hung up. I can't believe this.
He hung up, Gary.
Let's see if he comes back.
All right, I'll hang up.
Well, holy shit, I hate it.
Yeah.
Holy
yeah.
shit, I
so
hate it.
So I was listening to that in my living room, and both of my dogs were, like, really upset by it. And they're, like, you know, they had their, like, fur standing up. And mm-hmm. they were, like, Zoe came over to me, and she was, like, pawing at me and whining for me to turn it off.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That creeped me out almost more than listening to it, because I'm, like, man, they know, dogs know what's up.
They do. Animals always know.
So the Steven that Gary refers to is his older brother. Brian is his younger brother. And at the moment he received the first call, Gary thought it was Steven playing a prank on him, even though Steven wasn't known for practical jokes. It's possible a previous strange occurrence a year or so before made him suspicious. While en route to a wedding, also in Long Island, Steven claimed he saw Gary drive up alongside him, make some weird faces to get his attention, and then simply drive off. But Gary had already arrived at the wedding, and he was visiting from Texas and didn't have a car to drive, even though Steven's description of the car matched the one that Gary owned and drove in Texas, which he had never seen.
This is a year before the phone call was this wedding?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'm just making sure.
So Gary was sure that, like, when Steven tells him this, that he's pranking him.
Okay.
So during the first call, he's like, oh, you're on this shit again. Like, you're doing this. And then a few minutes after the first call comes in, second call comes in, and he presses the record button.
What is your question? Yes, speaking. Yes. Could I answer any questions for you?
Are you back from Texas?
Not back yet, no.
How long are you going to be back from Texas?
Let me answer. First, you tell me, where are you calling from? Yeah, why don't you tell me where you're calling from?
Who is this?
What do you mean, who is this? You should know who it is. It's me, Gary. Wait, let me ask you this question. Where are you calling from? Okay, I'll be back. Excuse me? I can't hear too well. Yeah, it is a full moon out. That's true. Could you identify yourself? Identify yourself. Why are you calling me? Excuse me? I cannot hear too well.
Get on the other phone, it's better.
Hold on, let me switch phones.
Okay.
Okay, hold on. Now, who are you?
Keep an eye in the sky, he said.
Keep an eye in the sky?
Yeah.
Can I talk to him?
Shh,
I had a sighting.
Okay, hold on. Repeat that again. Please repeat. Okay.
Near Orion.
Near Orion.
Holy mackerel. Tonight or guess on when?
The full moon.
Repeat. Okay, repeat last word. I'm hearing static.
Tell him I like to talk to him.
He hung up.
He hung up?
Hello?
Okay.
So, that one's harder to hear, and there is a transcript that I have. And the important stuff is that he repeats, "Keep an eye on the skies near Orion, the full moon." And he keeps saying that.
The only thing that's like keeping me from like peeing my pants listening to that phone call
is dad.
His dad too. I was gonna say, I have to remind myself of the cute little alien from Men in Black, and how mm-hmm. like Orion's belt was the cat's mm-hmm. collar.
There
and
you
like,
go.
Orion's belt, Men in Black, cats, everything's okay.
So by now it's probably pretty clear what the voice sounds like, and it seems to be a recording or a soundboard. It sounds slowed down as to disguise a voice. The phrases repeat, and there's a whirring sound sometimes between the phrases that could be the sound of a tape rewinding. It's also clear that Gary's dad is a UFO believer who thinks he's had a close encounter, which is another part of what's fueling Gary's skepticism, and making him sure that the calls must be a practical joke. And while he was arguing with his parents over whether the calls were made from his brothers or maybe even his friend Mike, the phone rang yet again.
Okay. Yeah, it's taking time from the talk. Who is this? Steven, this is not funny, you know.
Brian, it's not Steven.
What do you mean, Brian?
I mean, Gary.
How do I know it's not Steven?
It's not Steven. Hello? I had a UFO experience in West Virginia, which you probably know. And I know that you're an intergalactic person. Can you speak a little louder? Sir? Can you speak a little louder?
Let me speak to him, Dad. I guess I don't know what his...
All right, I'll hang up so you can talk to him. He wants to talk to you.
Okay. Hello, can I help you?
Hello?
Yes. Yes, that's me. Yes, could you please identify yourself? Identify. Yeah, I'm back. I'm in Texas right now. Oh, he asked me a question. No, I'm in New York right now. You know that. Why are you asking me such a question? Yes. Steven, if this is you, I swear to God, I'm going to be pissed. Huh? I'm trying to listen to him. Excuse me? Okay. Eventually, I'll be back from Texas. Could you speak more? Please speak more. I guess it's not Steven. I believe it because I'm getting static.
Steven would not raise three times.
Let me go on this phone because I can never hear on this phone. Hold on. Okay. Okay, please speak. Hello?
Keep an eye on the sky.
Okay. Should I go out right now?
Right now? Okay, see, I'm not sure where Orion is now, but we'll go outside. It would show double from me. Repeat that again.
So, the big takeaways from that phone call are the still insisting about Orion and the full moon, but then the thing that strikes me is it says show double from you or something that sounds like that.
Yeah.
And so their analysis here is many of the phrases repeat from previous calls, but even if they sound similar, this is what gets me. People who have talked about this, they're just like, it's a soundboard. But even if they sound similar, there are little differences in wording and pausing and phrasing. And if the calls were a soundboard, why would you record almost unnoticeable variants on the same phrase?
Yeah, I actually noticed that too, because I think it starts in the second call. And when he says, like, how long will you be returned from Texas or whatever he says? But he says, Texas.
Yeah, or like there's just like Gary Sudbrink.
Yeah, like there's a little bit of a stutter or like a hold on certain syllables, and it is terrifying.
Yeah. The volume also changes significantly with the voice getting fainter and harder to hear. Gary's dad was very spun up this time, and Gary himself starts to seem a little bit uneasy. He told his father that there had been a couple of odd incidents on his trip back home. In the airport in Texas, a man had approached him with a clipboard, with a friendly manner and a series of rapid-fire questions. What was his name? Did he live in Texas? Where was he going? Gary assumed he was taking a survey or selling something and brushed him off, but after boarding a plane, a different man sat beside him. Before they'd even buckled their seatbelts, you know, buttoned those seatbelts.
You know.
began peppering Gary with identical questions. His name, was he from Texas, where was he going, and how long would he be there? Before Gary could figure out if the man was just being polite, the cabin attendant told the man that he was sitting in the wrong assigned seat and that he had to move. When he deplaned, he didn't see the man anywhere among his fellow passengers. Gary's dad was wildly excited and convinced that an extraterrestrial was making contact with them. Gary was still convinced that it was a prank, and then a day later they were still arguing about it with Gary's uncle Tom, who's another UFO believer, and the last call comes in.
Oh my god, I'm not ready. I mean, I'm prepared, but I'm not ready.
Yes, this is me. Can I speak to you? Can I ask why you're... Yes, can I ask why you're calling? Can I please ask... Yes, this is. Yes, that is me. Say that again?
This planet.
Leave?
We come.
I'm staying right here.
To be within this planet.
Is this a joke or what? I have to think about that.
I'd like to see you.
Hey, let me tell you something. I've been listening to you. And I've had contacts with you.
Government interference.
Government interference? You have? Please explain what type of interference.
Sun will rise from the dark side of the moon.
Okay, what branch of the government? What should I do? Good for me or bad? They hung up.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna cry, and I've literally never hated anything as much as I hate this.
I'm so sorry.
I hate this. I'm gonna cry.
Okay. So, big takeaways here. We come to be within this planet. And then to visit the many, to be contacted as the same with you. Which he says multiple times. And then beware government interference. And I feel like my personal feelings on this were when he was like, I'd like to see you. And he was like, visitations to be disrupted by them. Like, you can't see me because the government will interfere.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sun will rise on the dark side of the moon. And then, again, show double from you, which is a fucking creepy-ass line. So that was the last time that they were contacted by the mysterious caller. In the intervening 25 years, no one has ever admitted to making these calls or knowing anything about their origin.
I don't like
it. In the last statement that anyone could find, or that the poster here could find from Gary, he was a guest at a UFO conference where the calls were played as possible Men in Black contact. Still seems convinced that the voice is somebody playing a joke on him, although his dad and uncle are sure that it was an actual otherworldly contact. But even from Gary's point of view, as a prank, it seems strange. Why direct the calls to Gary, a skeptic, instead of his dad, the true believer? Why stage something so elaborate and call so many times and then just stop? That's not much of a payoff for a practical joke. Gary's brothers are both close to his own age, so they were in their mid-20s or early 30s when the calls happened, and neither of them had a reputation of being a prankster. Neither did his friend Mike, who was ruled out anyway as he was speaking with Gary during the first call. No one else Gary knew was even aware that he had arrived back in Long Island and was at his parents' house. Could Gary have somehow arranged the calls himself? But if so, who was his accomplice making them, and why would he do it? Gary was no UFO believer, and he sounds more angry and exasperated during the calls than anything else. In the 2.5 decades since he got them, he's retired from the Air Force and has taken a job as chief pharmacist at a major hospital. He's a solid citizen with no history of making weird claims, and he doesn't seem eager to discuss the calls. I can only find one record of Gary making any public appearance associated with them, and that was as an unpaid guest at a UFO conference. Maybe instead of a prank, it was his dad and uncle, UFO true believers, who wanted to stage something that would convince Gary that other extraterrestrials were real. But Gary's dad was present during all of the calls, and his uncle was there for the last one. Besides, could two men in their late 60s, neither very technical, figure out how to make a soundboard or a vocoder? And since they were convinced themselves that UFOs were real, what would be the point of trying to hoax Gary, who they only saw once or twice a year, into belief with an elaborate fake setup? Who called Gary Sudbrink and why?
I don't fucking know.
There are a lot of people in the comments that are, like, just absolutely convinced that this is a prank. And some of them even get, like, really condescending and angry about it. Apparently there was a previous thread about it, but it was, like, completely deleted. And then they were, like, somebody on this thread was, like, Gary's YouTube channel is posted somewhere in the comments here.
Huh.
And I can't find it. Like, I was so convinced when I started looking this stuff up. Okay, I found the original post, but I was so convinced when I started looking this stuff up that I was like, okay, so it's supposed to be from the 90s, but I really can't find anything on it except, like, that's, like, I think the oldest thing I could find was 2015. So, like, why is it that nobody has ever talked about this on the internet until around 2015? So I was like, is this a modern day hoax?
Yeah.
Like, is Gary Sudbrink even a real person? Like, and then people claim that he has a YouTube channel, but I couldn't find it. And uh-huh. he is at that conference.
Right.
Like, there's a video of the conference that you can see on YouTube.
Do you know what year the conference is from?
Offhand? It's, like, from 2017. Hold on.
So, relatively recently.
Yeah, and that's why I was saying, like...
Because my question was going to be, like...
Why is all this stuff new? So, like... There have been two podcasts that have done episodes on it since 2018. Now we're, I guess, three.
Ugh.
There's, like, a few posts on Reddit.
Yeah, where did this come from?
There's a place that's called I Am Dark Waters, which is where I got the files from of the calls. And they have, like, information on there. But it's a very slow loading website. But it's like a blog post type thing, and I guess, like, the comments are from, like, 8 months ago.
So all of it is, like, at least, you know, like, barely, like, 4 years old. I'm not even going to say 5 years old, because we're barely into 2020.
Like, you can find pictures of him. And, like, I found, like, some of his, like, pharmacy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a pharmacist. Like, I found his, like...
records, kind of.
I found his LinkedIn.
Oh, wow.
So apparently he's still working.
Right.
But, yeah, there's just, like, if you search Gary Sudbrink, there's just, like, not a ton of information at all. And then... Where is that conference?
Yeah, like, so my thinking was, you know, maybe if, depending on when this con happened, like, if this con happened pre-2015, where you sort of see this information, then you have to ask yourself the question, like, where did this con hear about him to have him as a guest? But given that it was 2 years after the fact that this incident kind of, like, appeared on the internet. Like, it makes sense that someone could have, like, heard about him and, like, contacted him. But I kind of feel like if this was all a hoax, like, why would he, honestly, like, I mean, maybe this is counterintuitive, but why would he go to the con? Because it seems like you would just risk exposing yourself too much.
I don't know. Well, a lot of people don't think that he, a lot of people don't think that it was a prank from him. But then other people say if you speed up the voice, that it sounds like him.
Hmm.
But I did. I listened to the sped up voice. I don't think it sounds like him.
Really?
Hmm. I don't think so.
I...
So, I don't know. Maybe for a post-mortem or something, I will find, like, try to find some more info about it. But, yeah, there's not a lot of information. It's not very easy to find without really, really digging.
Yeah, and it's, like, the website that has the audio files, like, where did they get them from? You know? Like, where did any of this come from?
There are older posts of the audio files, like on YouTube, there's like an older one.
Hmm.
But the files like are uploaded to various different places.
Okay.
Like there's like this other YouTube like top five unknowns. It's like five most mysterious phone calls that cannot be explained, and that's from 2 years ago.
Gotcha.
There's another one. There was another one from two. It seems like there was kind of a blip in this case from 2 years ago. Well, and now it's like back.
It's, like, horrifying, so I can understand why people would want to talk about it. It reminds me a little bit of, and when you said that your thing was from the 90s and phone calls, and I kind of, like, picked up that it might be UFO-related, do you remember the one, and I think this one did turn out to be a hoax, but it's the one where, like, the guy calls into, what is that radio show where they talk about, like, UFO stuff? Coast to Coast, I think. The guy who, like, called into Coast to Coast, and he, like, claimed to, like, be someone who had worked for the military, and he was, like, just terminated, and he, like, knows some shit and saw some shit, and he, like, the guy who calls, like, he sounds so terrified, like, he's, like, crying on air, but it, like...
No.
And, it's, like, a hijacked phone call or something, because, like, he eventually hangs up, and the radio host is, like... Well, what, like, what the fuck was that? And, like, that's what this reminds me a lot of that in some ways, too. But that one did turn out to be a hoax.
Oh. I don't know if we'll ever know if this is a hoax or not, and I really don't know how old it is. I know how old it claims to be, and how old people say it is, and I feel like maybe there was more info about it another time, like, on the internet during another time.
Maybe.
But I did do some research. I will go and do some more research and see if I can find more about where this came from.
Yeah, like, maybe if we assume that it's not a hoax, maybe this was something that was previously around and then, like, kind of, like, wiped out.
Yeah. Government interference.
Exactly. You gotta use a VPN, you guys.
Because that's gonna definitely protect you from government interference.
Maybe, I don't know.
If you're an alien, please use a VPN.
Yes.
Which is why I use one.
That was bad. I mean, it was good, but it was bad. And I'm gonna have nightmares.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. I want to, like... Once this episode comes out, I want to make Charles listen to it, but I know he's going to have a night terror, and I'm going to be the one that has to, like, deal with it.
Oh, God. I was, like, actually a little bit concerned about him knowing about it.
I don't think that he does, because I feel like it would have...
No, I mean, up. Like, I'm concerned about him knowing about it for the sake of his own, like,
mental health.
Fear of aliens.
Yeah, no, I, like... I'm also, like, very uncomfortable with, like, alien UFO stuff. Like, we've talked before in the show, like, we briefly mentioned that, like, there are two things that scare me. One of them is pregnancy, and the other one is, like, weird alien shit. And this is definitely some weird alien shit.
Have you watched the movie Honeymoon?
No.
I would really recommend it.
Is it both of those things in one?
Yeah.
No! No! I don't want it.
It's so good. It's so good.
Oh my god.
It's an underrated horror movie.
I will at least look it up. I will at least look it up.
It's so awesome.
Oh my god. That was a really good topic. Thank you for sharing it. I kind of can't believe I've never heard of that before. But I guess maybe if it's like...
That's what I'm saying. Like, how do we not know about this? Where did this actually come from?
Yeah. It terrifies me, but I want it to be real. Like, if I found out this was a hoax, I would be really bummed.
We may find out one day that it is a hoax, but... You know what? My philosophy on it is, and I was telling Justin the same thing, because he actually found this, and I don't do any of my own work. My sister finds my stuff. Justin finds it. Somebody else finds it. But I was just like, you know what? Even if it is a hoax, it's a fucking amazing one.
Yeah, man.
It's an amazing hoax, and, like, it's like watching a really good horror movie.
Mm-hmm. You know what? We're living in the moment. As for all we know, this we have no reason to believe that this is a hoax, so.
Yeah. Well, we could get into that maybe in the postmortem, some of the reasons why people think it is, whatever.
Okay. I mean, unless you want to, but, like, we can also save it for a postmortem.
I think we should save it for a postmortem.
Okay, yeah, our run time's
My poor husband has been, like, trapped out into the living room this whole time.
Yeah. Sorry.
It's okay. He'll deal with it. Well, what do you guys think? What happened to the boys? What happened to them?
Yeah, were they kidnapped? Were they forced off the road? Did they just have an accident? Was one of them involved?
Yeah. And then, is this a hoax? And yes or no? And
also, if you know this one and have more information about this one, too, like, please let us know. Gary, if you're out there.
Gary, we would love to have you on the show.
Please, get on the show. Like, no pressure, no strings attached. I promise this is not government interference.
Yeah, we do not work for the government at all.
We just need some... I need more.
I wish I did. I get paid more.
Hey.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
Yeah, we have our normal stuff to plug. We have social medias. You can find the 13 Club on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We also, you probably saw on, if you follow our social media, you probably saw we've got our new website up and running where you can go back and listen to past episodes. Catch our old, like, blog posts that have, like, content on our sources for further reading. We have a Ko-Fi if you feel like you want to throw us a couple of bucks. We have the same goal that we've always had, which is to be able to afford a year of SoundCloud Pro, just to help us continue to host our stuff. And or feed our caffeine addictions.
Yep.
So...
And the one more thing.
Ooh.
Is that if you want to talk to us about anything or you have any requests or suggestions, send us an email at ask13, 13 is XIII, club@gmail.com.
Yes, please reach out to us. We love hearing from you guys. And obviously we're very responsive to suggestions, so.
Yeah.
Also leave us reviews, especially on iTunes.
Only if they're 5 stars, though.
I'll even accept, like, a 3-star.
No, nope, I won't.
I
do not leave that.
Please
just
don't.
Move on.
Please don't. But we do want iTunes reviews, so please consider leaving one for us if you feel so inclined. And I think that's probably all of our business.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. All right, well, I'm going to go piss my pants and try to get some sleep.
Okay. Good luck. Bye.
Bye, guys. Thanks for listening.